This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. A brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing against three African tribes in the Darfur region of western Sudan has driven more than 1 million people from their villages and killed tens of thousands. Attacks on the villagers continue by Arab militias supported by the pro-Islamic government of Sudan, and international observers warn that disease and malnutrition among the refugees could bring the death toll to the hundreds of thousands by year's end. Later in the program, we'll hear more about the roots of the conflict in Sudan. First, we'll speak with Rowan Gillies. He's international president of Doctors Without Borders, which has been working to improve health conditions among the Darfur refugees. Gillies is a surgeon from Sydney, Australia, who began working for Doctors Without Borders as a field doctor in Afghanistan. He recently visited Sudan and returned at the end of July. Among the sites he toured is a village called Mornay in western Darfur, where about 80,000 displaced people now live in a refugee camp. I asked him to describe what he saw when he walked through the camp.
You walk through, the children always follow you. The children are always excited to see Khawaja, which means white man in Arabic, and they follow you, talk to you, and chat to you. And then, but if you go and sit down in these small little huts, which are only about 5 feet high and maybe 8 feet wide, and they're covered in plastic tarpaulin, and there's a few sticks around it. And there's a little cooking pot there and a little, maybe a blanket, and usually a jerry can for water. And this is where three or four people live. And it's very hard to grasp what they feel about their future, where they're going, because they're stuck in a limbo, a life of limbo. When the camps don't have enough water, when there aren't latrines and they have to go and defecate in the field, when some of their family have had to go to the clinic because they're having constant diarrhea, when some members of their families have died in the mass displacement or they've died from the diseases from being so crowded afterwards, it's an incredibly vulnerable group of people. And I'm always surprised the dignity they still maintain. They still offer you in for a cup of tea. They even offer you food. And I feel incredibly guilty taking food from people who have very little food. However, I think the insult is greater for me to say, no, you're poor, I'm rich, I won't make it any worse for you.
What kind of food are you offered?
Beans, often the food that we've given out in distributions, or offer, usually a cup of tea, actually. A cup of tea and a bit of some beans or something. And I sit down, I don't eat very much, to be honest, and have a chat to them. But one of their abilities to keep their dignity is to keep behaving like they would in their normal lives. Their culture is to offer help to strangers and to offer hospitality to strangers, and I'm one of them, so they'll come and it's continuing their dignity, continuing their lives. But and the other thing I found very, very, very difficult to deal with was you go through the camps, you find a lot of elderly people. And when I say elderly, I mean 60, 65. They've gone through probably a number of displacements in their life because there have been difficulties in Darfur over the last 20, 30 years. And when the food comes to them, they often give it to their children because the children are vulnerable, or to the pregnant women. And they either don't have people to look after them or don't want people to spend too much time with them because they would rather look after the children. And they're often dying in these little camps with very little help and dying of starvation. And this is what we found. We started a little donkey cart going around the camp to look for people who cannot make it to the clinic, because we found that people were actually dying within their own structures. And on the first days the donkey came, there was elderly person after elderly person. We couldn't do a lot for them. Pretty much they had diarrhea, they were malnourished, so we brought them into the hospital, cleaned them up, gave them some food, have a bit of a chat, keep them in for a few days, and then take them home and try and make sure they've got a good food distribution for next time. So there's a lot of humanity still happening. There's a lot of children still laughing, and there's a lot of people getting on with their lives. But there's a basic underlying concern about where is their life going? What are they going to do in 6 months' time? And where is their next food coming from?
Give me a sense of the demographic makeup of the people that you've seen in the camps. I mean, are there old people, women, children?
Well, interesting you should say that. Yeah, interesting, because we've done a number of demographic studies and suggest there are disproportionately few numbers of men of what you call fighting age. And my impression is it's from two reasons. One is because there has been massive violence, and specifically the men have been killed. And secondly, the men are out trying to find food, whether they travel to Khartoum to get food or to get money and try and do things for their families. And the difficulty people face inside the camps on a demographic basis is quite stark. The men are too afraid to go outside the camp because they feel they will be killed by militias around them. The women of between the ages of, let's say, 12 and 40 have a reasonable chance of being raped if they go outside the camp. So it falls to the elderly women and the young children to go out to the camp to collect wood, to collect firewood and sometimes water. So people are coming across incredible decisional difficulties about what they should do. Should they send their men out to die or their children out to get beaten?
What kind of effort have international relief agencies been able to mount to relieve the suffering in Sudan?
Whenever you get displaced people, whatever the cause, I suppose there are a number of things you must address. Their housing, water, their sanitation, their medical care and their food. And different organisations have been involved in this. We are obviously much more focused on the medical side. But we've noticed that because of a lack of food, we've been forced to step into areas that we do occasionally but not a lot. We certainly often help malnourished children, but at the scale, I think currently we have about 2,000 children under five in therapeutic feeding centres. That's an incredible amount of children in what you would describe as an intensive care situation. If they're not treated in this therapeutic fashion, they will die in the next 2 to 3 months.
That is to say, their malnutrition has reached a point where they require intense intervention.
Exactly right. It's sometimes between 5 and 7 meals a day and certain medical protocols. We give them antibiotics and vitamin supplements and so on. So there's a lot of children that have reached that level because of the lack of food assistance. There's also a large number. We have around about 10,000 children we're also treating in supplementary feeding centres. So they haven't got to the level of need in the therapeutic centres, but they're on the downward slope, and we'd rather catch them there than go to the point of the intensive feeding centres. And then we're doing what we call blanket feeding, which is basically every child under five gets a ration every 10 days or so. And this is a ration for them, but also for their family. The fact that we're doing so much what we call blanket feeding in this area suggests that there has been insufficient food distribution, general food distribution over the last 6 months.
Are the difficulties the result of opposition from the government and letting the food get there? I mean, does it come in through Sudan or does it come in through Chad?
Comes in mainly through Sudan, not through Chad. There were certainly administrative difficulties earlier in the year. They have really opened up a lot now, and you can get a visa and you can get access and trucks in much more easily at this stage. I think there's also the wet season makes it more difficult, but we knew it was coming, so planning for that I don't think has been adequate. And there's money required by the different groups to do it, so the donation requirement hasn't been enough. And as well, I think there's been sort of some intransigence amongst many organisations and slowness to react over this whole crisis. And I would include us in that. We were one of the first to respond to this, but we felt we were late ourselves in our response.
Why have people been slow to respond?
I think this getting into the areas was very difficult with administrative constraints, with visas and so on. But also, I think it's that reluctance. My impression is there's been a reluctance to jump into this man-made crisis and in all the political difficulties that it involves. Unfortunately, you can't sort of step back from these crises and allow group people to be sacrificed because you're very worried about getting too involved in politics. We're certainly not involved in the politics that are going on, but we are always a victim to the politics, I suppose, that of the world politics and the internal politics that happen within Sudan.
When you reflect on your experience in Sudan, is there one particular moment, one experience that's left an enormous impression?
Yes, there's actually a few. I found after spending about a week in Darfur, I just reflected on the number of people I'd watched die, and it's sickening. It's sickening. Well, I'm watching a pregnant woman die of jaundice with a 4-month fetus inside, and there's very little you can do, and you look at the reasons why, and this it just didn't need to happen. And watching it's quite morbid in some ways, but watching someone die really concentrates you on the frustration and the anger you feel about what has happened to these people on many, many levels. It's not just the displacement, it's not the violence, it's everything, including the lack of assistance and in many ways the lack of caring from whether it be authorities or whether it be people in the rest of the world, that these people are going through these awful, awful times. and they will continue to do so over the next 6 months, probably over the next year or two. And the fact that it may not stop is incredibly upsetting.
Dr. Rowan Gillies, he's international president of Doctors Without Borders, and he recently visited the Darfur region of Sudan.